This is Rabbi Ethan Tucker of Mechon Hadar. Parashat Beha'alotcha, 5776. Uveyom simchatchem uvemoadechem uverashe chodshechem utkatem bachatzotzrot. Musical instruments on Shabbat and Yom Tov. Music has played a central role in religious rites across cultures and throughout time. And yet, traditional Jewish practice has mainly forbidden the use of musical instruments on Shabbat and Yom Tov, days that are uniquely focused on spirituality and on transcending the mundane. Why? What's the basis for this prohibition, both in the textual record and conceptually? How should we think about this prohibition today? We'll review the sources and suggest a few different models for thinking about this question. Let's begin with the meager but meaningful biblical evidence for the use of musical instruments on sacred days. The most explicit passage is the following from our parasha. Uviyom simchatchem uvemoadechem uvarashei chodshechem utkatem bachatzotzrot alalotechem valziv cheshalmechem v'hayu lachem lezikaron lifnei Eloheichem ani Adonai Eloheichem. And on your joyous occasions, appointed times and new moons, you shall sound trumpets when offering your burnt offerings and well-being offerings, and they shall be a reminder before your God, I am the Lord your God. Now this verse is explicit that horns are used as part of the temple service, at least on Yom Tov, and seemingly on Shabbat as well. Vayikra chapter 23 verse 24 and Bemidbar chapter 29 verse 1 describe the sounding of a horn, a truah, on the first day of the seventh month, known to us as Rosh Hashanah, which is described there as a Mikra Kodesh, or a Yom Tov. Vayikra chapter 25, verse 9, commands the sounding of a shofar in the Yovel, or Jubilee year, on the tenth day of the seventh month, Yom HaKippurim, described elsewhere not just as a Mikra Kodesh, but also a Shabbat Shabbaton, throughout the land, not just in the temple precincts. Tehillim, chapter 92, may make a practice involving musical instruments more explicit with regard to Shabbat. That psalm is titled Mizmor Shir Leyom HaShabbat, a psalm for the Shabbat day, and seems to have been part of the liturgy for that day, at least in the temple. The phrase, Alei Asor V'Alei Navel, Alei Higayon Bechinor, on a ten-stringed harp, on the melodious lyre, that seems to be an instruction to play these various stringed instruments on Shabbat. All of this is to say that the playing of instruments on Shabbat and Yom Tov is dealt with nonchalantly in the Bible, and based on this part of the canon alone, no one would ever dream of forbidding their use. Now, it's hard to find explicit evidence one way or the other regarding the use of musical instruments on Shabbat and Yom Tov in non-rabbinic sources from the Second Temple period. Scholars have recently faced off over whether such a prohibition can be found in one of the surviving fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Whether or not the text in question provides explicit evidence of a prohibition, it seems fairly obvious that at least some elements of the Dead Sea communities would have forbidden any use of musical instruments simply on account of their status as an instrument. In an earlier essay, I explored the origins of the rabbinic concept of muktzeh, the notion that all kinds of objects are off-limits on Shabbat. And that concept, in its purest form, insists that Shabbat is a day when we retreat from manipulating the world in any way, including a near total avoidance of the utensils we use for that manipulation and that are emblematic of it, tools. Tools represent the human dominance of the physical world, and they are a potential threat to emulating God's total stoppage on the seventh day after creation. We see this prohibition at work in some Dead Sea materials, where one is forbidden to save someone from drowning with a ladder or a rope on Shabbat. Here and elsewhere, we see a strong allergy to the use of tools, even non-transformative ones, like a ladder, even in potentially life-threatening situations. Offering one's hand or clothing to help a person out of a pit is fine. Once one reaches for a tool, one has violated the character of the day in a grave fashion. It's fairly clear that no one subscribing to those teachings would allow the use of musical instruments on Shabbat. Musical instruments are also tools. The Dead Sea Scroll material refers to a kli, which really means any human-fashioned utensil. Those means of affecting the world through human technology, and symbols of dominance over the environment. While we can't say for sure how such sources would have felt about music itself on Shabbat, its production through tools would seem quite obviously beyond what they could tolerate. This tradition would have to cabin off the biblical evidence we offered above as being highly specific to the temple precincts in the context of sacrificial worship. And indeed, there are a number of actions, such as the use of fire, that the Torah forbids on Shabbat and yet assumes are permissible and mandatory in the temple as part of the sacrificial regime. So in parallel, one could say, only where the Torah explicitly authorizes the use of such musical instruments would they be tolerated on Shabbat and Yom Tov. Otherwise, the obligation to withdraw from creation would demand that such tools be avoided at all costs. We'll return to this model and its subsequent echoes later on in our analysis. Rabbinic sources clearly inherit a prohibition on at least some musical instruments on Shabbat. That prohibition is, in fact, never explicitly articulated in classical sources, but it is assumed throughout. The reasons for this prohibition, however, vary depending on the text and the period of time. They can be organized into four models, and you can see the longer essay for documentation and analysis. First, avoiding loud noise. This approach focuses on decibel levels, not instruments per se. It draws strength from many Tanaitic sources, from many voices in the Talmud Yerushalmi, and Ula in the Talmud Bavli. All of these forbid loud sounds on Shabbat, including white noise, and including things like clapping and dancing and smacking. This formulation is favored by Rabbeinu Hananel, and the Meiri reports that the students of Ramban played soft musical instruments on Shabbat, showing that they must clearly have held a similar position, namely the problem is not musical instruments themselves, but excessive volume. A second path is avoiding musical and rhythmic noise. This approach cares about specific types of noise, but emphatically dismisses any concerns about white noise, and does not primarily engage the axis of volume. So, knocking on a door would be fine, but rhythmic clapping would be unacceptable, as would any generation of music through an instrument. It draws strength from Rabbah in the Talmud Bavli and the deflections offered there on his behalf, and it's picked up chiefly by the Rif, but also in the Meiri's deflection of Ramban's students' practice. This becomes the main view codified by Rav Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch. A third model is to pay attention to the derivative concern of making or fixing a musical instrument. This approach sees our entire topic as lacking a primary motivation. There's no concern about noise of any sort or music of any sort per se, just their potential for leading to the performance of an illegal milacha, the fear that by engaging with this kind of musical and rhythmic generation, one will eventually come to manipulate and fix and create, perhaps, musical instruments, which is forbidden as an act of construction on Shabbat. This approach draws strength from the formulation of the Stam, the anonymous Talmudic redactor, that this is the root of the problem, and it takes that explanation seriously as a matter of law, such that if the concern for some reason doesn't apply, perhaps the law can be suspended. The most prominent supporters of this approach are the Tosafot, who claim that since we're no longer expert in fixing musical instruments today, the prohibition on clapping and banging and dancing no longer applies. The Ravya supports this view as well. This picks up traction in Ashkenaz, especially, where you can see Rav Moshe Iserlis, the Rama in the Shulchan Aruch, endorsing the Tosafot's basic analysis. A fourth model focuses on muktzeh, or avoiding the inappropriate use of tools. In addition to whatever concerns we might have about certain kinds of loud noises, this approach sees the problem as the use of musical instruments. It unconsciously draws on the traditions we saw in the Dead Sea Scrolls material, and it taps into ancient rabbinic traditions that avoid tools on Shabbat, except for targeted activities. It produces one curious ruling by the Maharil, who, while he allows knocking on a door on Shabbat, forbids doing so with the door knocker, which is, of course, a kind of a tool. Now, I'd like to explore the last of these models as a way of understanding the debate about musical instruments most fully. The context I alluded to before, and in the earlier essay, should remind us that the original default setting of all tools in rabbinic culture was off-limits. Only tools that had a purpose were gradually brought into the material world of Shabbat. Even as this included category grew dramatically, some tools never made it in. Mishnah Shabbat gives us an example of the peg in a plow, or a large saw, as two such exceptions, tools that can't be moved at all. And I want to suggest that in a similar way, musical instruments were also an exception to the increasing permission of handling tools in rabbinic sources on Shabbat. It's not that someone decided to ban the use of musical instruments at some point in time. Rather, their exclusion from the material world of Shabbat is prior to all subsequent discussions of noise and music making. Even once those later legal cultures underwent dramatic shifts, the actual instruments themselves remained outside of the material culture of Shabbat, as much on an instinctive level as a legal one. Jews retained a residual vestigial opposition to the use of tools on Shabbat, even as they practically released formal prohibitions in this area virtually comprehensively. And so even if one dropped all instinctive and reasoned opposition to the generation of music on Shabbat, one would, if following this model, still deeply resist the use of a tool in order to generate this sort of sound. Now, indeed, I think this helps make great sense out of the broadly held permission, very prominent in Ashkenazi circles, to whistle on Shabbat. Ramah explicitly permits this. At first glance, it's hard to understand why whistling should be any different from playing a flute. Good whistlers can actually simulate the sound of a wind instrument. And indeed, from the perspective of any of our first three models, there's no reason to distinguish between the cases. Both generate noise, both generate rhythmic musical sound, and both might lead to making or fixing a musical instrument due to one's involvement with the music. But from the perspective of muktzeh, there is all the difference in the world. One uses a tool, and one doesn't. And this can also help explain why singing was never put on the table as problematic, no matter how musical and melodic it was. So I want to end with suggesting four basic practical ways that one might think about the question of using musical instruments on Shabbat and Yom Tov. First model, a community might attempt to create as quiet a Shabbat as possible, forbidding banging, loud dancing, and the use of musical instruments. This approach would accord with Ula and would say that Shabbat is intended to be a serene time with an atmosphere devoid of all loud sounds. One might still claim, as did Ramban's students, that certain instruments, such as an acoustic guitar played softly, or more conservatively, a tuning fork, fall below the threshold of concern. Such a community would have meaningful restrictions on volume, both with respect to musical instruments, no electric guitar, synthesizer, or drums, or wind instruments, and to other forms of noise, no clapping, no banging on tables as part of singing. In terms of the history of halakha, this was overwhelmingly the path not taken. Second model, a community might assert that musical noise has the power to affect the mood in ways that other noise does not, and that such an effect is against the spirit of the more relaxed, passive world we try to create on Shabbat. White noise is acceptable, so non-rhythmic table banging would be okay, but more manipulative and affecting noise, music, and rhythmic clapping and tabletop drumming would be avoided. This is more or less the approach of Rav Ovadia Yosef. Again, one might claim in a variation on this approach that certain sounds are soft enough that they fundamentally facilitate ongoing activities rather than shape them, the distinction between musical accompaniment and a concert, or more conservatively, something like a pitch pipe. But that last extension would be controversial. Third, a community might abandon all concern for any kind of noise, arguing that even the playing of very loud musical instruments is in keeping with the atmosphere of Shabbat. Given that this approach essentially ignores the insights of the first two approaches, it would only really be acceptable in halachic language once it had been established as a fact on the ground. And even then, its acceptance would likely be transitional and highly contested. One can imagine a sufficiently intensive and observant community that happens to have as one of its practices the playing of musical instruments on Shabbat, receiving justification for its behavior in this regard. It would remain contested, just as those articulations are contested, and many communities would reject the practice, just as there remain many Jewish communities that refrain from clapping or dancing on Shabbat and Yom Tov. That third model would essentially be, as are many cases of this sort of change, a historical gamble, where the communities using musical instruments on Shabbat without concern for their volume might succeed in creating sufficiently learned and observant communities to find a place within halachic discourse. Failing that, however justified this practice might seem to such a community, it's likely they would ultimately become a curious footnote in a larger halachic history that ultimately demanded some fidelity to the notion of noise and quiet playing a central role in determining the atmosphere of Shabbat. Finally, a community might say that we never use tools to generate noise or music on Shabbat, even as we have dropped all other restrictions on noisemaking. In practice, this is the way most traditionally Shabbat observant Ashkenazi Jews run things. This fourth model subconsciously taps into pre-rabbinic and early rabbinic restrictions around tools on Shabbat. Even as rabbinic Judaism has allowed more and more tools into the material culture of Shabbat, a ban on musical instruments is a meaningful and powerful vestige of that earlier model. This is perhaps simultaneously the most radical and the most conservative approach. It, following Tosafot, jettisons all of the sources around noise that anchored this conversation in the rabbinic period. But it also maintains a deep fidelity to an ancient tradition of withdrawing from the world on Shabbat. This topic is perhaps as good an example as one can find for feeling the difference between treating halacha as an obstacle to get around as opposed to as a source of wisdom for shaping one's practice. If one's entire goal is to find a way to play musical instruments on Shabbat, it's fairly clear that there are pathways to explore. There are clearly hooks on which one can hang one's hat, but one does so at the cost of a host of other insights, including manifesting at least some element of a culture of quiet, nervousness about overly manipulating the Shabbat atmosphere, and, perhaps most important, maintaining the value of a culture that steps back from tools on Shabbat. The collective force of the sources I lay out in the longer essay point clearly, in my view, to embracing a Shabbat where those tools are put aside when the day begins. As I said, I'm not for running the opposing view out of town, and I can imagine a rigorously observant Judaism that integrates musical instruments into its Shabbat practice. But a great deal would be lost, and it's not a choice I make for myself, nor do I recommend it to my colleagues and students. When we shift our thinking about halacha from legal compliance to growing in wisdom, sometimes the more restrictive option is the wiser one. The case of musical instruments on Shabbat is truly one where multiple voices compete for our attention. We can try to pick out the individual melody lines and listen to them alone, or we can attempt to hear the symphony in its entirety.